Hello, this is Court Watch with Alex Sawyer, and I'm excited to bring you the latest episode of my podcast, where I am joined by Adam Feldman, creator of the Empirical SCOTUS blog and a Supreme Court scholar. He has gathered the most recent term statistics and will share with us some of his observations. We will also discuss some of the major rulings this term involving former President Trump, abortion, guns, and the administrative state. To recap, the justices ruled on two major Trump cases this term. One involved keeping him on the Colorado ballot after a group of voters tried to remove him, arguing that the Constitution prevents someone who participated in an insurrection from holding office. The justices said that the state did not have the authority to do that. And in maybe the most important case in the court's recent history, the justices said a president is presumed immune from criminal prosecution for official acts, but they are not immune for unofficial acts. The ruling was not a straight win for Trump in that it leaves it to lower courts to decide what charges against him can and cannot stand. It will, though, delay any trial from taking place before the election, which is helpful to the former president. On abortion, the court ducked deciding the limits of the abortion pill, saying a group of pro-life doctors did not have standing to bring the case. And then the court also got rid of a case dealing with a federal law that guarantees emergency treatment in hospital emergency rooms. The Biden administration had argued the law requires states that ban abortion to perform them in hospital ERs. The justices said they took that case too early and will allow the litigation to continue in lower courts. On guns, the high court said a federal ban on machine guns did not apply to bump stocks and ruled that it is legal to temporarily disarm someone who has been found to be a dangerous person. That case was brought by a man under a domestic violence protection order. The High Court also overturned a 40-year-old precedent that allowed courts to defer to administrative agencies in determining how to implement a rule or legislation when the law was ambiguous, so long as the interpretation was reasonable. The ruling gives the power back to the courts to adjudicate the laws and cracks down on the administrative state. Adam Feldman now joins me to share some more highlights from the court's 2023 term. I wanted to first ask you about how you thought this term measured up in comparison to the past in terms of ideological divides. And there were some 6-3. I mean, one, I can't remember, was it the Fisher case? It was one of the cases where it was 6-3, mm-hmm. and I had to do a double take because it was actually Justice Jackson who sided with the conservative majority, and then Justice Barrett had gone and joined the two of the Democratic appointees. Yeah. So, you know, what did you make of the breakdowns?
So I think you raised an interesting point, which is that we had a bunch of ideological splits, and those were in some of the predicted cases. I think the one that at least I thought was most likely going to go down the long ideological lines at the outset when the grant, when the case court granted the case was Wilbur Bright. And that pretty much went as expected. I think,
right.
For most
the Chevron
people.
Case, right. The, yeah. the right. administrative state one.
Yeah. When they took that, I mean, they've reviewed these agency, related, deference cases for a while now with, some skepticism. And, so it seemed like the court was kind of maneuvering into a place where, that when they took a case that reviewed the Chevron precedent, that they were prepared to overrule it. So there was kind of a path of breadcrumbs that was moving towards that decision. And also the other agency-related cases this this term, aside from probably the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau case, all went in the direction of not giving more deference, more leeway to the agencies. So there were the predictable cases like that, but then, like you mentioned, there were certain cases where the court, including Corner Post, went against the direction that the public might have thought in terms of the ideological splits. So there as many as there were cases where the court split along 6-3 lines. Predictably, there were a similar number of cases where the court split along 6-3 lines, and it wasn't along those that ideological fracture. So it wasn't quite as many predicted that there was going to be this overwhelming number of 6-3 splits. And really, I think it's more of a question of, is there a difference in the cases where the court split 3 along ideological lines than there was in cases where there wasn't this type of ideological split?
And on that, were you surprised with the Trump immunity case that there wasn't more, I guess, bipartisan agreement, if we want to call it that?
Yeah, I was. My take after oral argument was that there was going to be greater agreement about the general sense of immunity, and then the details were going to be hammered out between maybe concurrences rather than dissents. It seems like the court, the majority, really pushed a little bit further than the dissent was willing to go in terms of giving a president almost blanket immunity for official acts in office. Now, when in reading it, it read to me like a kind of the next in sequence after the Trump versus Hawaii case of, I believe, 2017, when the court ruled that Trump's travel ban was constitutionally protected, didn't violate the First Amendment, and the court spoke a lot about the office of the presidency and the importance of protecting the presidency rather than necessarily protecting any specific person in office, but the office itself. And it seemed to me that the majority made a similar statement this time around, where the court wasn't basing the decision on specific facts in a specific case as much as it was trying to articulate a rule of law that mm-hmm. could be followed. And the rule of law was predicated on the importance of protecting a president, not any one president.
Yeah. And then in that reading, something that I thought was interesting was the word pardon was used to describe, I guess, like a core presidential function. And the court, the majority said, like, these core presidential functions have absolute immunity. Then there was kind of this gray area where it's like presumed immunity for what could be official acts, right? And then it's like non-official acts, no immunity. But when we talk about pardons, there was nothing mentioned about pardoning oneself, but they talked about how that is a core presidential function and is entitled to absolute immunity. Did they open the door for if Trump were to win in November? I mean, what if he were to pardon himself? I don't know. I just kind of, when I was reading that one part, I was like, whoa.
Yeah. I mean, they, as the court is often does, it left a significant gray area in the decision. And I think, the pardon, self-pardon is one aspect of this. But I think the in terms of like a broader brushstroke, it's really this notion of what is an official act, because there are things that are clearly official. There are probably some things that are very clearly unofficial, but those are going to be kind of at the edges. But then there's a pretty broad territory that is this possibly official, possibly unofficial. So, it speaks to the court leaving area open, and really, this is a case that is going back down on remand. So right. In terms of the, what is actually going to happen based on the Supreme Court's decision, we don't know how it's going to be applied, but I think there's frustration from the political left in that it's probably going to drag out the case until after the election.
Right. And so, I guess it could even, like, what is technically an official act? I mean, certain instances, like you said, a fact pattern could come back to the justices, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think that that's beyond the likelihood of possibility anyway. I think the immediate frustration that some people are voicing just has to do with how it's going to impact the election right now. And then I think secondarily, a concern that's been raised is that it creates a monarchy instead of a democracy. It's just, to me, unclear in terms of how it's going to actually play out. I don't think that the Supreme Court gave that kind of sneak preview on this is how it's going to be used and this is the type of protection it's going to give a president, but rather clarify a doctrine which has been very, very vague for a long time, because there just haven't been that many executive immunity cases, even cases that might have gone down that line, like the Nixon case, mm-hmm. Didn't actually go to immunity because it stopped at the question of privilege. Mm-hmm. So, this is a vague doctrine where the Supreme Court's giving a little bit more definition now, but we really don't know how it's going to play out aside from the likelihood that this is going to drag the case past the November deadline for the election.
And it looked to me from the data you put together at Empirical SCOTUS that Kavanaugh and Roberts seem to be in the most agreement among the justices. I think that was how it's been in prior terms. Is that accurate?
So yes and no. The highest agreement is this term, and I think it's been the last few terms, is actually between Sotomayor and Kagan. The left tends to agree, at a very high rate, and part of that is because it's a smaller coalition. But in terms of the Kavanaugh-Roberts alignment is really important for the center of the court, kind of defining the direction the court goes. And that's because not only are they in agreement a lot, but they are and have been over the last several terms the justices that are in the majority the most frequently. So not only do they agree with each other, but they agree with each other in terms of the direction the court is going. Mm-hmm. So they're really, at kind of the front of the court's business. They have a high level of agreement. They're in the majority in almost every decision. And since Roberts is the assigning justice of the majority opinions in cases when he's in the majority, which is 96% of the time this term, means he's the one that's saying who's going to author the opinion, which gives him at least a little bit of say so in terms of what he thinks the direction the majority should and is going to go based on the authoring justice.
And where do you think Barrett falls with them? We've watched her, I guess, since 2020 when she joined the court. And I remember during the confirmation hearings, she was painted like she would be like an uber conservative member of the court. But I don't know. Do you think that's been a fair assessment? Or what do we know about her now that we have a couple of terms under to look at?
I think there's more nuance to Barrett, definitely more than even I think I assumed at the outset. In terms of her jurisprudence, both in terms of some pushback against the far kind of conservative end of some of the decisions, and some of her agreement in cases where, a couple of terms ago, I saw kind of a different directional push. We have in terms of the disagreements with some of the other justices on the right. Cases like in the Vidal versus Elster, her concurrence where she is talking about the value of history and how we shouldn't necessarily be bound to it in the same way that Thomas discusses its importance. So in terms of like an interpretive strategy, she's not necessarily on board with all of the other justices on the right of the court. We've seen some movement in an opposite direction. This was from not only Barrett, but I think it was important to see Barrett. For instance, in the FDA case, while the court dealt with a decision on standing, it was another one of these abortion-related decisions where the court held this time that at least it wasn't going to block the abortion pill from accessibility, and similarly in the Moyle case, another abortion decision, where Barrett was on the side of the court, allowing these emergency abortions. So, it's not exactly the same justice who was so clearly in the majority in Dobbs. We're seeing a little bit of nuance. We're seeing a little bit of distance between her and Thomas, in other cases, her and Alito. I think she's probably a little bit more moderate, to the extent to which I don't think we truly know yet, but at least, I don't think we can necessarily say that she's a carbon copy of any other justice in particular.
Mm-hmm. And then Justice Jackson, she joined the court in 2022. I saw, according to your statistics, that she spoke the most out of the justices during oral arguments. And then I thought I'd ask you if we learned anything more about her, maybe where she falls on the bench. Do we have any idea?
Yeah, I think you made an interesting and important point early on, talking about the Fisher case, where she was in the majority with mainly conservative justices. You have the other two liberal justices in dissent. It was the January 6th case where they were looking at what can be prosecuted, under those terms. And Justice Jackson, who had past work in the public defender's office, I think that probably plays a role in her criminal justice jurisprudence. And that's one of the reasons, I think, that she was really looking at the text of the statute and not necessarily as much about preference based in terms of criminal defendant versus the state. So, you know, I think we see a little bit of difference from her. I mean, another interesting point is just that she was in the majority a little bit more than Justice Kagan and Sotomayor this term. So there was a little bit more that we saw from her in terms of making the alliances with justices that maybe, you know, she doesn't agree with, you know, most of the time. But you know, there are these little shades of nuance. But in terms of, you know, if I'm going to make a prediction about how she's going to vote, my gut is going to be if, you know, we see Kagan and or Sotomayor in one direction, we're probably going to see Jackson follow. Mm-hmm. There's just going to be a few exceptions to that.
It kind of reminded me of when we were talking about Justice Barrett, like the both sides kind of painted Justice Barrett and then Justice Jackson like as extremists during their confirmation mm-hmm. hearings. And then when they've actually been on the court, like the past few terms, it seems like, or what we're getting from them, I guess, most recently with the Justice Jackson's addition, it just doesn't seem like that's the case. They aren't on the far ends of the court, at least what we've noticed. Do you think that's fair?
I think with Justice Barrett, I think we can make an easier argument for that because we've seen a few terms and I've actually seen a little bit of change and at least we can say there's like some more detail in our understanding of her decision making. Just as I probably wouldn't have said that it was super clear in that 2021 term with Barrett, I think I would give Jackson another term or so before making a clear statement on how I thought she was moving in terms of her own jurisprudence. It usually takes about three terms for a new justice to really say they've concretely defined themselves as a justice separate from all justices, all other justices on the court. So we've seen a little bit from Jackson, but I think we've seen more from Barrett to say that she's really unique and, you know, probably falls somewhere in the middle of the court, is conservative, but is not conservative in exactly the same way as a Thomas or a Roberts.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, there was a case that I didn't think got as much attention as maybe it deserved. That was the Purdue Pharma bankruptcy case. Mm-hmm. It dealt with the makers, I guess, was it OxyContin? Is that how? Yeah. And then their family, right? Like it was the bankruptcy deal with the company, but then the family had shielded themselves from the bankruptcy, from litigation, basically third party litigation. And I think the majority of the victims had signed on to the deal. Some opposed. And the court actually said that these types of deals can't go through because unless you have everyone sign on. And so, I guess the reason there's been a lot of attention, or at least in the newsroom, people have asked me about it, was one bankruptcy expert had said, like, this has like a huge effect on like Boy Scouts of America bankruptcy or like a litigation like that, the Catholic Church, potential mm-hmm. Johnson & Johnson. Like, what's your make? Do you agree with that? Like, do you think it should be getting more attention in terms of like the fallout from it, or is it too early to know?
I think there's a few points that key into the importance of this case. One of which was just, this is one of the ones at the outset of the term that seemed really kind of interesting because it, you know, bankruptcy cases don't get a lot of attention in the Supreme Court. And this was a pretty high profile one in the lower courts. So it was kind of unique for the justices to take this on. This came down as a 5-4 decision, which is also an indicator of kind of not only importance, but deep-seated differences in the court. It came down along lines that were not purely ideological. You know, you had two of the, this is actually another one where you have Jackson in the majority and you have Sotomayor and Kagan in dissent. And Robertson and Kavanaugh, you know, are in dissent in this case also. And they, you know, as I mentioned before, were in the majority, you know, 96 and I believe 94% of the time. So, you know, all of the kind of quantitative indicators point at the importance of this case. But then in terms of the application and the kind of qualitative aspect of the rule of law, it does implicate other kind of high volume, high dollar amount bankruptcy cases and getting authorization for these. And you know, especially just going through the importance of kind of a deeper fact-finding approach and a more detailed look at the settlement that's being made before court just accepting it and kind of taking into account the interests of all of those potentially affected, not only all of those who have signed on.
Right. Yeah, I thought that was a very interesting one. You're right. It was one of those cases, so many of them, I think we talk a lot about at the beginning of the term, and then it was all the Trump cases just kind of took over the focus, really, at the end. Anything else? Before I let you go, you've been very generous with your time. Was there any other observations that we haven't mentioned that you think deserve a highlight?
Oh, I think that we kind of touched on this at the beginning, but this is really for me one of the major themes is what's going to happen to agency deference moving forward. And there's the Loper Bright case that overturned Chevron, but there are a lot of other ones. I mentioned Corner Post for a minute, and there's SEC versus Jarkissi. There were some immigration cases, and we see that in some instances the court is willing to side with the agencies. I think the CFPB case was the one that was kind of most prominent in that respect. But primarily that the court is really not willing to defer to agencies in the same way that the Supreme Court has in the past. And I think that that's going to change litigation the most moving forward from this term, is that we're just going to see courts analyze agency decision making in an entirely new way. And it's going to create a lot of litigation, both in the trial courts, but also in the appeals courts, because the process by which courts can now review agency decision making isn't totally clear. So I think that's going to spur a ton of litigation. And we're going to be developing probably new textbooks in administrative law, because most of them were predicated on the Chevron case in the past. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely a key point. I think there's one other. It's just an interesting one that a few folks have asked me about so far since the term is finished, is what to make of the court's review of Fifth Circuit decisions, because there were more Fifth Circuit decisions as a percentage of the court's docket than there generally are in the past.
Yeah.
Fifth Circuit numbers were almost parallel to the Ninth Circuit, which almost always is far ahead of all other circuits in terms of the number of cases the court reviews. And the court reversed about 75% of the decisions coming from the Fifth, which were primarily decisions that one would probably code as being conservative in nature. So I think that was an interesting point, for folks who are with this narrative that the court is the Supreme Court is so conservative right now, in terms of a relative nature. It's probably not as conservative as the Fifth Circuit, and definitely not as conservative as some of these panels where the court has overturned these lower court Fifth Circuit decisions that were seen as kind of big, bold, conservative moves.
Right. Well, and even I think sometimes, I don't know if we want to go this far, but like the abortion pill, for example, I guess the Fifth Circuit didn't go as far as the district court there, but even how they shaped the case that the justices took, they didn't take the question about the overall FDA's original, I guess, approval of the abortion pill, which was what was one of the cases presented or one of the arguments. Right. So, they kind of didn't go as far there. But I appreciate your time. Thank you so much. I know we're about to hit the July 4th holiday. So I hope you are maybe getting away after all of this work. Hopefully sneak away for some R&R.
I hope so too. Thanks.
All right. Bye. Thanks for tuning in to the latest episode of Court Watch. If you have not subscribed yet to this podcast, please do so. And also feel free to email me interesting questions or topics you want explored about the legal reporting world. I'll do my best to answer them during each episode. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to hearing from you all soon. Listen to my podcast, Court Watch, at WashingtonTimes.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.